I understand that you first came to Western Michigan University driving a Studebaker, which then promptly died when you got here.
Your understanding is absolutely correct. That's I came up to start Western Michigan University in 1963, having first attended Wayne State University, then Detroit Institute of Technology, and then as I was looking toward, at some point, relatively soon, graduating with a degree in arts and sciences, and I could not, for the life of me, think of a job that I could go interview for, saying I've just graduated from Detroit Institute of Technology in arts and sciences, and I'd like to work for you. And so as I looked at that, I had been up to Western before and was very impressed with the campus and with the young men and women who attended. And so I decided that I would transfer to Western. And I thought when I went to Western, because of its phenomenal experience in turning out outstanding graduates in education, and because I had friends who taught high school history, that I wanted to be, and I enjoyed history when I was in high school and in college, that I wanted to be a high school history teacher. And met for the first time a great counselor who suggested that I might want to rethink what I want to do because there were so many high school history teachers and so many students majoring in history. I would be fortunate if I could find a job somewhere teaching in junior high school and teaching history.
Mm-hmm.
I said, think about it. So I went back to the dorm. This first time I've been away from home, and the dorm that I could afford to stay in was Vanderkook Hall, which we affectionately referred to as Hungry Hall. It's the only dorm that did not serve food in terms of breakfast, lunch, dinner, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But it was affordable. And so I went back to the dorm and walked into the room, and there on the dresser that we both shared was a stack of mail of, looked to be about 18 inches tall, and from different boards of education. And so, I mean, I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked around and said, well, what's his major? And they said special education. And so I waited for George Waters to return, and I asked him about it, and he shared with me what he would be doing. And I said, you know, I'd like that. So I went back to see my counselor, and I said I'd like to get a degree in special education for the educable mentally retarded. Today we just refer to our students as learning disabled. And so that's how I got there. I came up, had everything that I needed and owned in that Studebaker. And when I got behind the dorm, the car just died. One of the windows, the rear window, was a four-door Studebaker. One of the windows had broken out, and so I had a plastic raincoat that I put in. I was freezing coming up. But I got there, and the car died, and I kept getting tickets on the car because I couldn't move it.
Right.
So I contacted the police department, the campus police, and said, look, my car died. I can't move it. Can we do each other a favor? You all turn it in, get whatever money you can for turning it in or for whatever you might do, and you all forgive me on the tickets, which they did.
So you see, right there at the beginning, that wonderful gift for negotiation and turning a bad situation into something wonderful. That story that you just told is just one of many, many stories that are in your new book called Let the Future Begin. And I wanted to talk to you about that, your
Sure.
autobiography. Why don't we go back to what prompted you to write it? What's that message that you really want to convey to the readers of this book?
What prompted me to write it was my wife of long standing. She was the one who encouraged me to go to law school. And ultimately I did and fell in love with the law. And then I did the smartest thing I think I've ever done in my life. I married the teacher who suggested I go to law school. And so
there's always that good woman behind the man.
Listen, in this case, she was ahead of me. I was just fortunate. In any event, she encouraged me to go to law school, and so I did. And after having had the privilege of practicing law and having the the privilege of being presidents of different bar associations, serving on the Supreme Court, and then really privileged to be mayor of the city of Detroit for two terms before I decided I wouldn't run again. She encouraged me to write a book so that our grandchildren, we have two grandsons, they're 9 and 12, would be able to appreciate what I tried to do with my life, and that I could also share with the public what I did while growing up and going to school and having been mayor. Because, as she pointed out, you've had the benefit of the press writing about you, but they wrote about what they saw and what they felt was important. But if you write this book, you'll be able to leave a legacy for your grandchildren. And there are a lot of things that, as I thought about it, our two sons, adult sons, did not know about me. That I told them a lot about me, but, you know, you don't, there's some things you either inadvertently leave out or whatever, and I wanted them to know. And so that's what motivated me to write it. And as I wrote it, it occurred to me that I thought that young people would see how I grew up, having been born in Detroit and 5 years of age, moving to Cassopolis, population 1,200 people, great community. We did not have running water. And so we had an outhouse, and we had a honey pot that we used at night. I mean, there was a lot of... We didn't have running water. I took a bath in a metal tub every Saturday night.
Yeah, the book begins with this story of poverty, and I was intrigued, too, that your father sent your mother, when she was about to give birth, to Detroit so that she would have a hospital. And you didn't see your father for those first years.
No, I didn't. And he was very thoughtful and very concerned because in Cassopolis, we didn't have a hospital. Still don't have a hospital. Adopted, we don't have a hospital. Niles, Michigan, that's 14 miles away. South Bend, Indiana, is a distance 24 miles away from Cassopolis. And my dad didn't have a car. And so, you know, you never can tell when somebody is, your wife is going to have her water break and need to go to the hospital for a potential delivery. Mm-hmm. And so he just felt that it would be wise to have me born in a hospital. And so my grandmother, and which was my mother's mother, and her sister and three brothers had already moved to Detroit. And so we were sent to Detroit, and I was born in Dorothy Rogers Hospital in Detroit. And I lived there for 5 years and then returned to Cassopolis and met my dad for the first time. My mom and everybody told me about my dad. Mm-hmm. And how he was concerned about all of us, loved us, cared about us, etc. And I was excited to meet him. And he turned out to be just an outstanding father who taught me a lot.
Yeah. So paint for our listeners a picture of Detroit back in those years, those first years that you were living there. What it was like for an African American.
Well, I will make this observation. At that time, I was born January 1st, 1942. The following year, 1943, Detroit had a real race riot, a riot that was started based upon race and racism. It was whites against blacks against whites, and about 43 people were killed, but the population continued to grow. Population of the city of Detroit grew to about 1.9 million people at its high point in 1953-54 before people started moving outside of the city and wanting to be where it was quiet, I guess, to hear the cows moo and the chickens crow or whatever. They moved out and started to move out. In Detroit, when I was growing up the first 5 years of my life, I'd go downtown with my grandmother or my mother, and it was people all over everywhere, and businesses downtown, and we would go to the Verner's soft drink facility and get vanilla ice cream and Verner's ice cream or Verner's pop. We would go to Kresge Five and Dime, and my mother would go down, grandmother would go down the basement and would buy chicken wings, for example, which was about maybe 7 or 10 cents a pound. And we walked back home. She was an outstanding cook. And I just remember doing those kinds of things and going down and looking at Christmas time and looking in the windows, et cetera, mm-hmm. during the first 5 years of my life. It was just, I mean, it's people all over. And then when I moved to Cassopolis with a population of 1,200 people, there was a distinguishing difference. When we got out of the car, it was just like it was silence because you wouldn't hear the traffic and you wouldn't hear the noise and the culture and the vibrancy of a large city. Mm-hmm. And yet that's where, while it started for me at an early age, that's where I really was taught values and by my mom and dad. And my grandmother and mother had done it or started it already when we were in Detroit. My mother was taught me my numbers and my colors before I started kindergarten in Detroit. But when I moved to Cassopolis, they wanted to start me in kindergarten again. And my mother said, no way, he's going to start in the first grade. They acquiesced. And they made it very clear. My dad had a third grade education. He lost his arm just above his left elbow in a car accident before I was born. And they didn't have what we have today, like Americans with Disabilities Act. And it was hard for him to find a job. So he worked for a gentleman by the name of Floyd Westcott, who Winterholm was in Sarasota, Florida, and his summer home was on Diamond Lake in Cassopolis, Michigan. He owned a tool and die shop in South Bend, Indiana, and my dad took care of his summer home in Cassopolis. My mother had a high school diploma, which was the norm back then in the day, but they made it very clear to me. As long as I can remember, they made it very, very clear to me that I was going to go to college. And therefore, I had to get good grades. And I knew at an early age that teachers were always right. I found that out when sometimes if I did something that might have been inappropriate, though we didn't have a telephone, they found out about it before I got home.
That's the kind of value of community.
Absolutely.
And it takes a village.
And I will tell you, it was like, by and large, remember when Hillary Clinton wrote this book, It Takes a Village to Raise mm-hmm. a Child? Well, it's true. I mean, when I would come home on report card day in Cassopolis, even people who did not have children knew it was report card day, and they would not hesitate to stop you. Come on over here, baby. Let me see that report card. And if it happened to be nice things on there, you might get a piece of candy. Mm. But if there was something down there that they thought that I should have done better, wouldn't be surprised to get a pie upside the head and a lecture, don't let me see these grades or whatever they saw they didn't like on the next report card.
Walking the gauntlet all the way home, eh?
Absolutely.
So when you went to school, and as you said, your parents both really encouraged you to go on and for higher institutions of education, and you became a teacher for disabled students, I can imagine what you taught them. What did they teach you?
Well, it helped me appreciate patience, which is what is needed, I think, for anyone to teach. But clearly, if you're working with learning disabled students, it's awfully important to have the patience to work with the students that we are privileged to teach and work with. And so I would leave school, go home, change clothes, because at the time when I was teaching, I'd either wear slacks, sport jacket, tie, or a suit or tie, etc. I'd go home and change, put on jeans or khakis or something, come back to the school, and I might get involved in a pickup game of softball or something, or I'd stop by the homes of some of my students to talk with the parents to let them know what they could do at home to best help our students or their children. And so I enjoyed that. The principal, Violet Vardy, I taught at a bunch of elementary schools, suggested that I ought to consider being a principal because I got along so well with the students and with my fellow teachers. Mm-hmm. And she said, but you're going to have to get a master's degree in education. And I started taking two classes down at the Rackham Building, which is where University of Michigan taught its master's classes before you moved on and had to go on campus in Ann Arbor. But the two books that I used were the same two books that I used at Western Michigan University. And so I was sharing this with the teacher I was dating and saying, I don't know, why are we using these books? These are the same books that I used when I was at Western, and she then started talking, why don't you think about going to law school?
Mm.
And I said, no, I don't know anything about being a lawyer. I've never been in a lawyer's office. I don't know what they do, et cetera. The more I whined, or I should say complained, perhaps whined, about taking the classes, the more she suggested that I ought to think about going to law school. So I took the law school admissions test, got a score that suggested that if I applied myself and worked hard in school, that I had a chance to graduate from law school. I knew that if I graduated from law school, I'd have to take what is called the bar exam.
Yeah.
And I'd have to be able to pass the bar exam before I practiced law. Nobody could guarantee you that any of this would be done, but it was an opportunity. And so I seized upon it, went to law school, and was able to graduate and pass the bar the first time and start practicing law.
And as you became a lawyer, as you write in the book, you begin to see that there are so few African-American lawyers out there. And that seems to become part of your mission as you progress as a lawyer, to pull in other African-Americans into the profession. Maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. At the time, the difference between being a African-American lawyer or another African-American profession, well, an African-American physician was assured to have a patient base. An African-American teacher was assured to have an opportunity to teach, whether it happened to be in a segregated school or whatever, you could still practice your profession. But to be a lawyer, the lawyers were not, for example, the American Bar Association would not allow anybody even to apply to become a member until about 1943, when they changed their applications, which back in 1908 they changed to require you to list your ethnicity on the application to become a member. And if lawyers in that community did not recognize the name, they would go by the office where one was practicing law to make sure that you were not a person of color. And so that did not bode well for encouraging people of color, blacks, to go to law school.
Mm.
And so there were very few of us. And today, for example, we are still underrepresented. About 10.4% of us are lawyers of color. Today, that's African-American, that's Hispanics, Asians, Middle Eastern, et cetera, people from India. I mean, we are still underrepresented today. And so I observed that when I was in law school. And in fact, when I was in law school and I started in the spring semester of 1966, there were very, very few women of any color.
Yeah.
In my law school class, and that was the same across the country. Today, there's been a dramatic change, and women represent today at or more than 50% of the students going to law school. And so a lot of things have changed. But for those of us of color, we still have to make sure that we are encouraging young people at an early age, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, to start thinking about law school, to share with them what lawyers of color, and in particular African Americans, have done to help society, and what has been done by lawyers, such as at the time when I grew up, I knew about a Thurgood Marshall because of what he did and what was done at Harvard, at Howard University, with the lawyers who went to law school there. For example, again, referring to Mr. Justice Thurgood Marshall, he graduated from college in Maryland, but he couldn't go to a law school in Maryland because they wouldn't allow blacks to go to law school. So he went to Howard, which was a blessing at the end of the day. And as a result, he was so high-powered and influential in issues of civil rights and civil liberties, and what he did with a great team of other lawyers, which included whites and women, to open up the doors for those of us of color through Brown versus the Board of Education and other cases, that it really made a difference for us. But we still need to encourage today African-Americans to consider law, because no matter what you may think of what's occurring today, there's still the court system to go in and to seek to right the wrongs that we see or observe or believe have taken place. And lawyers can do that, and they play such a positive role. And therefore, it's important to have lawyers of color who have grown up in the community, who understand the community, to be able to give back to the community through their legal talents.
And you made it all the way to Associate Justice of Michigan's Supreme Court, a wonderful accomplishment.
It was a real wonderful opportunity to serve, and I felt very privileged. The first person of color to serve on our Michigan Supreme Court was Otis Smith. He had had other offices within the state, but he was appointed to serve on our Michigan Supreme Court. He was, when he was seeking election to return to the Michigan Supreme Court, he was defeated by Thomas Brennan, who was a Wayne County Circuit Court judge and went on to start the Thomas Cooley Law School after he resigned from the bench. And so it had been a 20-year absence of not having a person of color on the Michigan Supreme Court when Governor James Blanchard nominated me in, or appointed me in 1985, and to take the seat of Mr. Justice James Ryan when he was elevated to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which took place in January of 1986. That's when I was sworn in January of 1986 and became a member of the seven-member Michigan Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is an awesome responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It is rare to find a person appointed to or running from the practice of law to serve on the court, or being appointed as a trial lawyer to serve on the Michigan Supreme Court. Most people arrive there because they've served as a judge in other courts, whether it's circuit court, probate court, or the Court of Appeals.
And then you make a decision, as you're an associate justice, to run for mayor of Detroit and eventually becoming the 59th mayor for two terms. How did you make that decision? And I'm fascinated, too, to hear you talk about what you write about in your book, Thoughts for a Greater Detroit. You had a unique approach to campaigning.
I had been encouraged, and people had talked to me right after I got elected to retain my seat on the Supreme Court, that I ought to think about running for mayor. Well, Coleman Young was our mayor and had been mayor at that point. He was just been elected to his fifth term, and there were some issues that were occurring related to the city. Businesses were moving outside of the city. People were not investing in the city. We were starting to experience, because of the economy and the need to reduce the deficit and the like, the crime was rising. As reported in the newspapers, kids were being injured or killed over jackets, gym shoes, designer sunglasses, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses were in, we had a lot of storefronts that were closed and boarded up, and we had people leaving the city, and they've been leaving the city since 1954.
Yeah.
We had a population just over a million people, according to the 1990 census, and we're 1,027,000. And we got that, frankly, because the Census Department had originally came in with a number, I think, in the 900,000 range, and Mayor Young would not accept that, so he put his appointees out and others and volunteers to demonstrate that we had more. So the Census Department originally said, or ultimately said, okay, population city of Detroit is 1,027,000. But it also reported that the city of Detroit had the highest percentage of people living below poverty. It was 32.2%.
Mm-hmm.
When you factored in the number of children who live below poverty, the number of children who lived in households living below poverty was about 46.6%.
Mm.
People needed jobs. They needed to find jobs because the jobs had moved outside of the city of Detroit. And people who were working outside those who did not own cars or couldn't connect with a neighbor who or someone who was driving to where the job was, they'd have to take two or three buses to get there. And so there was a lot of concern. And so I started thinking about that. And what sort of motivated me were a couple of things. I didn't know it. First of all, Mayor Young was someone that I admired and respected. Mayor Young was someone whose campaign for his first reelection in 1977, I was privileged to be his campaign manager working under Robert Millender, who was the campaign director. And so I had a high regard for him, but I was troubled by what I was seeing in the city as I drove around. And so when Governor Blanchard lost his election to then State Majority Leader John Engler, I then went to Governor Blanchard and said, look, I'm thinking about running for mayor. And according to state statute, I've got to resign 1 year before the primary of the office that I was going to seek outside of the judiciary. And if I resign, I'd love for you to please consider appointing a person of color to take my place, because I don't want us to be without representation on the court, because that court is so important. He said he'd do it. Mm-hmm. And I resigned, and he appointed Conrad Mallett to be the member of the Michigan Supreme Court to take my spot. I went up to, in December of 1990, I went up to visit with President James Duderstadt, who's the president of the University of Michigan, and ask him if he thought he could find perhaps five or six, seven professors who'd be willing to work with me, because I was thinking about running for mayor. Mm-hmm. And that would be awful helpful. And turns out he was able to do that. And we met from January, February of 1991 until the end of May 1991. And we'd have meetings out at in Livonia at the Observer and Obcentric newspapers owned by Phil Power. Phil Power's wife was my campaign manager when I ran to keep my seat on the Michigan Supreme Court, and I had a chance to meet him. Mm-hmm. And it was his newspaper's headquarters was between Detroit and Ann Arbor. And so it made it convenient where the professors would invite people from around the country who had experience solutions for problems we were facing in Detroit, and I invited people from Detroit who were familiar with the issues that we were confronted with. And so we went about the business of looking for solutions to the problems, because I knew if I was going to be running against Mayor Coleman Young, I couldn't stand up to the microphone and say, my name is Dennis Archer, I'm a former member of the Michigan Supreme Court, I love my city, and I think I'm qualified to run, I think I could do a great job. And then in the press conference, somebody said, well, what are you going to do about housing? What are you going to do about crime?
Right.
I knew I could not say at that point, well, we're going to have a white paper that we're going to share with. I needed to have answers then. And so that's the reason why we came up with the Thoughts for Greater Detroit. And if you are familiar with it at all, that document led with an executive summary which said, and this, I finished that paper and sent it out to over 1,000 people in November of 1991. When people went to their doorstep on January 1st of 2001, they were picking up their newspapers, which talked about Detroit turning itself around and becoming a world-class city, and laid out what they would find in the city 10 years out. That was what I used to go into people's homes that I was invited to, their backyards, to churches, to college campuses, and having town hall meetings from 91 through the beginning of November 1992, when I announced my candidacy for mayor. I wanted to be able to share with the public what I thought initially it would take to turn our city around, but I wanted to hear from them.
Yeah.
What do you want for your city? What is it that you would be excited about having, doing, and how would you be willing to help? Because I wanted to be their document, not mine. And so when I announced, I was very fortunate to have Congressman George Crockett, whose campaign I ran for Congress to take Charles Diggs' spot, who resigned from office, and there was a special election. In any event, he had represented Mayor Coleman Young, when Coleman Young was very active in the labor movement, he was called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. George Crockett represented him there, did an outstanding job, and Coleman Young was just outstanding in terms of his testimony before the House Committee. And ultimately, before he became congressman, George Crockett was the corporation counsel for the city of Detroit at the request of Mayor Young. So there's that, all of that kind of synergy. And so when I announced my candidacy in November of 92, George Crockett came and said that he was supporting my candidacy and called upon Mayor Young to support me.
But he didn't, did he?
No, he didn't. He supported in the primary the chairman of the Wayne County Board of Commissioners, Art Blackwell.
Mm-hmm.
And when he lost in the primary and I won, the person who came in second, I had 53% of the vote when I came in second, or I came in first, Sharon McPhail came in second, and he supported her. And so it was on.
Yeah.
And I worked as hard as I could work. Nobody outworked me. I know that. We had over 6,000 volunteers who believed in Thoughts for a Greater Detroit and what we could do and accomplish. And when we won and the transition team was getting things, they were going through and working with the various departments of the city to learn what each needed, et cetera, and where each stood. Jay Alex, who was on the transition team, went to visit with the finance director of the city of Detroit and found that we were going to inherit an $88.5 million deficit. I have all these plans that we wanted to put in place, and we're going to inherit an $88.5 million deficit. We went to New York together. He was brilliant. He was able to help me navigate to work with Moody's and Standard & Poor's, which already had us at non-investment grades on our bonds, and the city had to buy insurance to sell our bonds in order to get things done within the city. He helped me work through, and we balanced the end of his budget, and I had a balanced budget every year that I was in office.
Mm.
I had a modest rainy day fund. I had a modest surplus, and at one point, newspapers wrote that the two pension funds, because of the economy that had been so great with President Clinton and his administration, we were overfunded in our pension funds for police and fire and for our general employees. And so it was an interesting start, and we were very fortunate to have things come together.
I don't know if it's fortunate so much as, for one thing, you have a wonderful ability to pull together an enthused team of committed people. And this wasn't just administration. It was the community of Detroit. In your inaugural address, in fact, you asked everyone to get out there and sweep your sidewalk, clean your alleys, pick up trash. In other words, we're all in this together. And you yourself, in an effort called Detroit Clean Sweep, you got into coveralls and did some garbage cleaning up yourself.
I did. I will tell you, one of the things that I've learned a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything I would not do myself.
Yeah.
And therefore, I felt it was absolutely important that I get out there. So I had a white coveralls that I wore and a baseball cap, and I would be out picking up trash, et cetera, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
My staff got on me and said, "Why are you doing that? I'm doing it." Our community in the city of Detroit, it's just a fabulous community. We had, on Clean Sweep, we started out, I think, the first year with maybe about 7,500 people or maybe a little bit more. And the last year I was in office, we had over 50,000 people on Clean Sweep. And that 50,000 people also included school children who cleaned up around their schools. The first year we cleaned up around the schools, the volunteers and the like. We did city parks and clean that up, picked up trash so the kids could play in the park and be able to do so and to enjoy. And so we had strong community involvement. After my first year in office where I got burnt, we changed Devil's Night into Angel's Night.
Yeah. Devil's Night being Halloween in Detroit, where there was this awful thing of people starting fires all over the city.
Well, think about this. People were trying to sell their houses because when you don't have 1,800,000 people live in a city and the population was around a million or less than a million people, you had over 800,000 people no longer in the city and no longer needed housing, and people trying to sell houses couldn't sell it. And so there was some arson involved.
Yeah.
And that happened during Mayor Young's administration, but he calmed it down and reduced it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got in the first year, and we assumed incorrectly that there was so much enthusiasm, positive feeling about the future, there would not be this problem again. Well, I got burnt, and it did not happen again. And so we had the volunteers out in huge numbers that also were available to help when issues came up. For example, in one of my years, our schoolgirls being assaulted on the way to school. Well, mm-hmm. I went to the religious community. I went to the volunteers who helped with Angels Night, and they put the yellow lights on top of their cars. I went to the businesses in the city who had trucks like the utility companies and others, taxi cabs, to watch out for our kids. I had parents walking their kids to school, etc. And we not only reduced and stopped the schoolgirl assaults, we caught the people that were doing it. And you can't do that without the community.
Yeah.
The community was just fabulous. And they were always looking for ways to try to give back to improve our city. You can't find a more enthusiastic, voluntary group of men and women and children who loved their city than we had in the city of Detroit. It was just fabulous.
And Detroit had that unfortunate reputation for being the murder capital of the country there for a while. A big part of what you did, it seems, is increase the police presence.
I did that. That was part of the initiative that grew out of thoughts for a greater Detroit, because I went to people whose opinion that I trusted and valued and said, how can we cause people to want to feel free in their city, where senior citizens could feel free going to church, etc. It worked. President Clinton had a cops program, and I got as many police officers as I could
mm-hmm.
for the police department. We had to commit that we wouldn't lay them off as soon as the funding went out. We put police officers on the street. Ike McKinnon was our police chief. And we put them from behind the desk out walking the beat and engaged in the community where people knew the police officers that were representing the community. And so we reduced crime every year that I was in office. And then Benny Napoleon took his spot and did a superb job when I stepped down as chief. And then Charles Wilson stepped in when Benny resigned and went on do other things. Right now, Benny Napoleon, of course, is the Wayne County Sheriff, and Ike McKinnon was the deputy mayor under the current mayor, Mike Duggan, and Charles Wilson is head of security at the Greektown Casino.
So you've cleaned up the streets, you've increased police presence and reduced crime, you're bringing in new business developments, you've also created a sports and entertainment destination out of Detroit.
One of the things that occurred to me about great cities was that they have strong cultural arts and that they have sports and professional teams and, of course, colleges that have sports, baseball, basketball, football, etc. Detroit already had some great cultural arts. Many people are unaware, only New York City has more theater seats than the city of Detroit.
Hmm.
And we were able to utilize that thanks to the Illiches in terms of their Fox Theater, the way they utilize Cobo Arena, the Joe Louis Arena where the hockey team played, and we had the Detroit Opera Theater that was coming online. We had the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, which was world-class, and the Detroit Institute of Arts, the And as I was coming in, we were building a new African-American Museum of History, and we had the Detroit Institute of Arts and Historical Museum. So we had great cultural art.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of sports, when I first came in, Mayor Young had tried to work with the state legislature to come up with the state's funding of a new baseball stadium. You might recall that when the owner of the Detroit Tigers was a gentleman who was a CEO and the founder of Domino's Pizza.
Yes.
He purchased the Detroit Tigers, and he was also able to attract Bo Schembechler, who was the phenomenal football coach at the University of Michigan, to be his president. And what they proposed to do was to move from Tiger Stadium and to move to a particular area, which in fact where the two stadiums now happen to be, Ford Field and Comerica Park. But what they had in mind was to build a baseball stadium and parking around the stadium so that people could come in off the freeway, get onto the parking structure, park their car, go in, watch a football game, come out, and they could get back in their cars, get in on the freeway, and drive back home outside the city of Detroit. Mayor Young would have none of that. Fortunately, Mike Ilitch, who'd been a baseball fan all of his life, who had also brought into the city of Detroit, moved from the Olympia Stadium, which was on Grand River,
mm-hmm.
in the city of Detroit, and moved it to downtown where Mayor Young had caused Joe Louis Arena to be built. And he also decided to buy the Detroit Tigers, which he did. Then he tried to get a new stadium that was built. Because Tiger Stadium, at that time, was really, everybody loved the park, but it was not able to undergo the kind of substantial physical changes that would be needed to try to get a modern, update stadium.
Yeah.
And so Mike Ilitch wanted to build a new baseball stadium. The mayor, Mayor Coleman Young, wanted to build one as well. They worked hard at it to work with Governor Engler, but the legislature just could not put their arms around it at the time to provide the funding source. So when I became mayor, that was on my doorstep. And I wanted to make sure that we had a competitive city. I wanted to make sure that if we could change Tiger Stadium or retrofit it as they've done Wrigley Field in Chicago, where the Chicago Cubs play, if we could do that, fine. But if not, then we were going to have to find a way to build a new stadium. Well, I met with engineers and others who shared with me that there was no way that we could safely retrofit Tiger Stadium to cause the stadium to have the kind of suites and other amenities that would allow the Ilitches to be able to have a revenue source that they could use to hire the players needed to be able to bring us a championship baseball team again. And so I went around to different stadiums. I went to new stadiums. I went to Baltimore, where the Baltimore Orioles play, several others, and was convinced that the only way we could become competitive would be to build a new baseball stadium. Well, for those who loved the baseball Tiger Stadium and wanted to be retrofit, they got signatures and put it on the ballot and said the city of Detroit could not contribute any money to build a new stadium. Well, we responded by putting a ballot proposal on saying, yes, the city could, if it was in its best interest, put money into a new stadium. Well, we won, they lost, so we could proceed with building a new stadium. And then, wouldn't you know, the good Lord smiled on us, and I got a telephone call from Bill Ford, Jr.,
mm-hmm.
and he said, Mr. Mayor, we are trying to work some things out with the city of Pontiac, but we can't seem to find our way clear. It doesn't look like that we can be able to keep the Detroit Lions in Pontiac. Would you be interested in having them come back to the city of Detroit. It didn't take me long to say, yes, absolutely, would love to have you come back. Don't want to interfere with the city of Pontiac,
yeah,
as I wouldn't want anything to interfere with what we might be doing with negotiations with others. We want to stay in Detroit, but if you can't work it out, we would love to have you. And it turned out that I then went to Ed McNamara, who was a county executive, and said, we can bring the Lions back, but we need to come up with more money. And he then came up with the idea that they would be able to sell some property, do some stuff that could raise one big source of money. And then with another source of money, he and we would go to the hotels and to the car rental agencies and ask them to accept a tax on the hotels and on the car rentals so that we would have sufficient money. We could then have both stadiums built in Detroit. We needed to have a ballot referendum. We were able to get the ballot referendum passed, and thus we now have Ford Field, and we also have Comerica Park. And so we've had in Ford Field, we've had our Lions there, and we've had the Super Bowl committed to the city of Detroit even before the stadium was completely finished. And we've had the All-Star game in the city of Detroit at Comerica Park. That has been just a dream come true to get the Lions back. And so what did we learn from all of that? No, more importantly, what did Chris Illich learn on behalf of Olympia Entertainment and the Illich family? Continuing to love the city as they did, they started amassing property, putting together a package, a proposal that went before city council and passed that allowed them to build the Little Caesars Arena, where the Detroit Red Wings would move from the Joe Louis Arena to the Little Caesars Arena, and there'd be a new stadium with new amenities, et cetera. And lo and behold, the greatest thing at all could happen was that Tom Gorris, influenced, I believe, by his good friend Dan Gilbert, decided to bring the Pistons, after some 35 years, back to the city of Detroit. And so now Little Caesars Arena, and they made accommodations and worked out their relationship. Little Caesars Arena, this past fall, opened with the Detroit Red Wings, our hockey team, and the Detroit Pistons, our basketball team, playing in the same arena. And for those who are familiar with sports, you think about Staples Center out in Los Angeles, where the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team, the L.A. Lakers basketball team, and the L.A. Kings hockey team play in the same arena. And in Chicago, the Chicago Bulls, in a house that Michael Jordan built, and the Chicago Blackhawks, which is the hockey team, they play in the same arena. Now we've got the same kind of thing. So in Detroit, we now have the Lions, the Tigers, the Pistons, and the Red Wings all play in the city of Detroit. And while we missed out this time, I believe next year Ford Field will be able to host, and we will have a new soccer team, hopefully opened by the by Tom Gorris and Dan Gilbert. We will have a soccer team, a professional soccer team in Detroit. Nowhere in the United States, I believe, will they have the kind of sports activities, professional sports, as we will in Detroit. That will be phenomenal. Help attract the young people who have moved back into the city of Detroit. One could not buy, rent, or lease a townhouse, condominium, or loft. There's a number of apartments that have now been built. People are moving back into the city of Detroit. They're moving into Midtown Detroit, and they're moving and starting. You're starting to see housing built throughout the city. Mm. It is really a phenomenal place and things that have occurred.
And with all of that comes business.
Yes, and jobs. Because when you have jobs, people are paying taxes, mm-hmm, for income taxes, and new businesses are opening up, are paying property taxes. Those two sources of revenue, property tax and income tax, is a source of revenue that allows the city of Detroit to be able to pay for city services and the like. And having gone through bankruptcy as a result of what was left on the table after Mayor Kilpatrick left office, and in effect saddled Mayor Dave Bing with a $315 million deficit and was running out of money, and they couldn't seemingly work out their differences. Governor Snyder appointed Kevin Orr as emergency financial manager, who tried to meet with the unions and everybody to see if they couldn't settle and agree upon how to erase the deficit and no money to pay for it because the city is running out of money. He ultimately had to go into bankruptcy. And the very people who fought him initially, because they didn't understand at the outset, they didn't understand how horrific this whole thing was and how serious it was, he was able to win the support of the unions and others to be able to sign off and help cause the bankruptcy judge to agree upon the new plan for the city of Detroit that's left the city council and Mayor Mike Duggan with a revenue stream that allows them to be able to pay our bills. And they've been able to amass a modest surplus at the end of each year following bankruptcy that has caused things to grow. And you know what? If you would come to the city of Detroit during the summertime, there's a group that's involved called the Slow Roll. It's an African-American who started a bicycle company in Detroit, came up with an idea. And on any given Tuesday, you would not be surprised to see anywhere in the toward the end of the day, about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock or so, seeing between 1,500 and 4,500 people riding bicycles and with a police escort throughout the city of Detroit.
Wonderful.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And you walk along our waterfront and the new housing that's being built, et cetera. It is just a great thing to see and experience in the city of Detroit.
So I wonder if, as we wind this up, you have some final thoughts for Detroit, for Michigan, perhaps even for the country.
One of the things that I learned from all of this is that it takes everybody working together. That doesn't mean that everybody has the same point of view. You're always going to have some who disagree, or maybe a lot that will disagree initially with a thoughtful plan of action. But if it is a good plan of action that people can understand and respect, put their arms around, and see value, jobs, and other kinds of things that will help the community. I mean, this year, for example, was the first year through the work of the new superintendent of our Detroit Public Schools, but we had an increase of the students enrolling in our Detroit Public Schools. I mean, that's awfully important. There's a lot of hard work underway to make sure that our students in our high schools and in elementary schools, K through 12, get an outstanding education so that they can be competitive. People are working again, and where I was able to implement through using Executive Order 4 the use of a number of minority businesses to help build up the casinos, to help build the two new stadiums, CompuWare building coming in downtown. Chris Ellis used the same formula, and without any kind of need of urging or requesting, etc., he adopted that same kind of format. And so a number of businesses, black businesses, and other businesses of color have been and are causing our city to be rebuilt, and they're hiring people. And then we've had investment coming in from Chase Bank through Jamie Dimon, $50 million being invested in the city, helping people to find, create jobs, investing in housing and things of that nature. Then you've got Goldman Sachs and Warren Buffett creating opportunities for new businesses to who want to grow and prosper, to enter into a program that if they're successful, they're giving funding in which to be able to grow. The foundation community, under my administration, we had, thanks to the hard work of David Smidra and Tina Dorse, et cetera, they attracted over $500 million of new investment in the city of Detroit and our suburbs, working together on issues that would help those who are in need. That same kind of thing is being done today. It is a great opportunity for young people, and we just need to encourage everybody to work together. And the foundation has been laid. It's there, and is working, and it just, I think the enthusiasm is entirely infectious. When you see the number of people downtown who are walking after work and who are going to our sports and our cultural arts and things of that nature, we've got a very vibrant city that helps the state. And this Amazon had announced that they were going to choose a city to open up their second corporate headquarters. Mm-hmm. Well, Detroit has applied. Dan Gilbert is chair with 56 people who all contributed and worked hard, made a pitch. That pitch is just really outstanding. It is absolutely outstanding. It reminds me of when the Clinton-Gore administration came up with an announcement about having an empowerment zone, which would cause the federal government to invest over $100 million into a city, provide tax incentives for businesses to grow. Nobody even thought about the city of Detroit being a winner of that. They talked about New York, they talked about Los Angeles, Atlanta, etc. But thanks to Gloria Robinson, who I was able to attract away from county executives, Ed McNamara's office, she became our point person, along with Nettie Seabrook, Dave Smidra, and others, came up with a program that was enhanced by Brenda Snyder, who at the time was a senior vice president at Comerica Bank. We came up with a $1.92 billion commitment for the empowerment zone, and Peter Schweitzer on his public relations firm came up with a video that he did pro bono, and the city of Detroit had the absolute best application, and the city of Detroit on December 21st, 1994, was announced as a winner of the empowerment zone. I fully expect and hope that Detroit is the beneficiary of the work of Dan Gilbert and the 56 people who put that together, because it's not just something for Detroit. It is a region, and it's not just a region, but it's the state, the entire state. You think about Western Michigan University and the number of college grads that they can provide for Amazon and their workforce that they may need, then the ability to do that, and the other colleges and universities across Michigan. But also think about this. Windsor, Ontario is involved. So it's an international, regional, and state effort to cause Amazon to be successful should they come here. And if they come and they invest the $50 billion to make their company grow, think about the number of jobs. And they're going to work on this and create the kinds of opportunities whether we win it or not. But I really have a lot of faith that Amazon will choose the city of Detroit. By choosing it, they will make a major statement in terms of how corporate America can make a difference in the lives of a community.
I will certainly be watching with great interest. Well, thank you so much for your generosity of time to talk with me.
Well, no, it's been my privilege, and I can't thank you enough for having read the book and be comfortable with the knowledge base that you asked, the kind of penetrating and important questions that I think hopefully will attract the reader to at least know and feel that there's a lot of positive energy that's occurring in Detroit. And for those who have children or grandchildren, to know that there's a bright future in Michigan. There's a bright future for all of us. But we need to work together.
May it be so. Thank you.
No, thank you.